Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to the podcast, Alex.
Thank you, Kenneth, for the second opportunity, right, to speak with you on everything Vietnam, especially Vietnamese history. And
you know, there's a recent groundswell to recount and reframe the narratives of the South Vietnamese government before 1975. Can you talk a little bit about this movement?
Historians, but also as an observer of historical narratives, right? You can see that in the past, like 5-10 years, if you want to push a bit further, you know, 15 years, there is a growing movement that has emerged, not simply to recount the narratives of the South Vietnamese government before 1975, but really to fill the long-standing gaps in how Vietnamese history has been told. Right, the movement is not limited to South Vietnam or South Vietnamese people, but rather it seeks to recover voices, lives, and experiences both in South and North Vietnam. Right, in Vietnam as well as in the diaspora that for over years have been kind of neglected and or erased by the dominant narratives. For decades, historical accounts have really been shaped by the victors of war, the Vietnamese Communist Party, and by, you know, the powerful, right? The U.S. and Western scholars primarily, who are primarily concerned with explaining communist triumph. So as a result, the Republic of Vietnam and those associated with it, right, have often been sidelined, their complexity really flattened or ignored, right? Being called like puppet regime, illegitimate, things like that, right? So today, with the new generations of scholar, younger scholar, usually mostly Vietnamese in the diaspora, like, you know, we have like Nguyen Tran or Kevin Pham on your programs, right? Tuấn Hoàn or Diệu Hương, Nguyễn, Y Thiên Nguyên, Cindy Nguyên at UCLA, Sean Fear, Leeds in London, following the footsteps of those before, like the Thuyen Vu and the Edward Millers, and many others, you know, are kind of pushing back against this erasure, right? So these are scholars, younger scholars who has kind of like a background in history, language, and culture, and are attuned to the political sensitivities of the period as well as contemporary, right? So they are kind of reframing Vietnamese history with a greater nuance, kind of restoring that long-standing voices and kind of enabling for a more, I would argue, a more complete, honest, and reckoning with Vietnam's past.
You know, I had been thinking about Vietnam, South Vietnam's government as a puppet regime for so many years too. I mean, because you hear that term floating around. And as I'm speaking more with people like Kevin Pham, beginning to understand that it's not quite what we think it is. You know, it wasn't a puppet regime. I mean, it might have sounded like that because, you know, we're reaching out to the U.S. for money, and it might have felt like that. But as I get closer and deeper into studying about President Thiel or the generals, we realize that they had strong convictions. They had a moral compass that they were going by. But I think that, you know, when the superpowers that control the money and the support, the fire support, it becomes very complicated, and it's easy for another side to shape, or, you know, the victors to really spin how they need to once they win. And I think that's just the result of the end of the war, right?
Yeah, definitely. A comparative case is Ukraine right now, right? Kind of to sustain itself as a weaker state, you know, relatively compared to Russia, it has to rely on the U.S. and the EU, right? Yeah. But what if one day that, you know, it no longer exists? How would the narrative be about it, right? We already see that narrative, right? That is just a puppet, kind of like, right? But behind that, we see the convictions that is often not talked about when we talk about South Vietnam or those who work under that regime, right? In American narratives, you know, when you study Vietnam history or the Vietnam War history in America, you rarely ever see that narrative at all. If you open, you know, textbook for high schoolers, you would mostly see 5 to 10 lines about the Republic of Vietnam, and mostly negatives, right? And so it's easy for people like yourself and myself who are either born or raised here in America, growing up within that context, to learn the history and kind of adopt that narrative about ourselves, about our parents, right? Thus kind of internalize that kind of narrative for ourselves, right? That's not to say one is right or one is wrong, or the Republic of Vietnam is this grand government or all good or whatnot. That's not the purpose of history. The purpose of history is that we have to recognize that it used to exist, right? And it exists with a certain belief, a certain conviction that you just mentioned. When you read more, when scholar like Nữ Anh, who writes about Ngô Đình Diệm, who helps to clarify our understanding of him, Sean Fear, who's writing about the Second Republic and Nguyễn Văn Thiệu, helps with that, and Kevin Pham, you know, with the different ideas that influence the constructions of the nation building in South Vietnam, right? So with newer scholarships by younger scholar that explores into the depth and the genesis of issues that created not just the Vietnam War, but these institutions help us have a better understanding of our past.
In your research, have you ever encountered like any surprising new insights or lesser known ideas that, you know, our Vietnamese community, you know, after 1975, you know, things that we don't know to kind of open up the broader understanding of Vietnamese history?
Yeah, definitely. There's always a lot, right? In research, whatever you find, when you go into a library, an archive, or just talk to people, right? Like, for example, I'm very excited for next week, getting a chance to just meet a lot of people of the older generation, right? And the younger generations too, and talking to them. Each time you talk to people, it really opens you up to different ideas, right? And so one of the most, for me, surprising and revealing insight is the deep gap in understanding and empathy within the Vietnamese community itself, across different generations, across languages. Like, you know, our generations, we speak mostly English. Our parents' generations speak mostly Vietnamese, for example, and live experience, right? We have very different living experiences, right? Us being raised here in America as opposed to our parents' generations who were raised in Vietnam and come to America, right? Their mentality is very different from ours. So this disconnect has kind of limited our ability to grasp the broader narrative of the Vietnam War and the refugees' experience. The first generation refugees often write in Vietnamese, right? They write their memoirs in Vietnamese. They write their novels in Vietnamese. They write their poetry in Vietnamese, and they write newspapers in Vietnamese, rooted in memories of loss and longing for their homeland, that is Vietnam. While the second generation, the 1.5 generation, the third generation, like myself, like yourself, like the Viet Thanh Nguyen, right, writes in English, right? We reflect in English, life in the diaspora, right? And so language really has a way of shaping our identity and how we reflect our past and our present, right? So these narratives, what if you observe it, don't really meet, right? As much as people like myself, or as much as people like Viet Thanh Nguyen or Ocean Vuong read, they don't necessarily engage with the writings of Mai Thảo, of Nguyen Sa, or the poetry of Trần Hoài Thư. So if I mention those names, they might not even know who they are.
I don't even right? know who they are. Yeah.
Right. And they are some of the most important writers of Vietnamese history, modern Vietnamese history, not just in the diaspora. But you can make the argument the reverse, right? The older generations don't read the work of the Ocean Vuong, the Viet Thanh Nguyen, because of the language barrier, right? Because of the communication. So this lack of, for me, this lack of engagement across these lines mean that we're not only risk misunderstanding each other, right? But also we miss the opportunity to recognize each other's existence and experiences. For me, that is very important. We're not recognizing each other's existence, and which is, for me, an essential step toward building a more nuanced collective history. So bridging this gap is important. And through, I believe, through conversation, through translation, and through shared reflection in forums whereby we can bring each other together is crucial. And without it, we remain kind of fragmented, right? With different representation. One can have a Mai Thảo as a representative. One can have a Viet Thanh Nguyen as a representative in this corner. One can have an Ocean Vuong or a Christina Vo at these separate corners. And our understanding of the war and its aftermath becomes kind of like incomplete, right? The scatter, right? They're not really meshed together to allow us and the next generation to see the whole picture.
That's a really comprehensive response. And it leads me to thinking about the identity of so many different waves now. Now that you've mentioned the language barrier, the gap that exists, there is now a new wave of Vietnamese immigrants coming from Vietnam as, I think it's called Du Học Sinh, international students from Vietnam, that arguably are in a different class financially and socioeconomically from anything that we have seen in the refugee community. And they're oftentimes looked at like people from another planet because they do come from a different socioeconomic class, but they're typically, not all of them, but they're typically wealthier and they're typically of children, people, families in power, or power and from the people who are at odds with the current Vietnamese diaspora people. And it's an interesting mix because eventually these two parts of the Vietnamese narrative have to get together and get along. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. But I want your thoughts. I want your thoughts on how you see these waves influencing the identity and sense of belonging in the U.S. and the entire world.
Yeah, I mean that is a very good question, and it's a question that I strongly also recognize. Right, I haven't co-edited a volume on Vietnamese American history. I see that as a component in which we cannot ignore when talking about the history of Vietnamese diaspora, the Vietnamese Americans' experience in the future, right? I remember as a college student when I was at Berkeley, recognizing that a lot of international students do not apply to Berkeley or schools in California, but rather more in the East Coast because they were trying to avoid the Vietnamese community, because when they went to Vietnam, they heard of all these narratives about, you know, the Vietnamese community here could be very anti-communist and whatnot, right? And so, but things have changed a lot now. From what recent past few years, what I've heard is that Little Saigon in Orange County is no longer Little Saigon. It's more Little Hanoi, right? So I, you live there. I don't, not anymore, right? So I don't know if that's true, but in a way you can see that that change, that that dynamic, right? But going back to your question, which I think is crucial, is that we have to recognize that the identity of the Vietnamese diaspora, especially in America, has long been shaped by three waves of immigrants, right? Following April 30th, 1975, you know, those who fled immediately, the 130,000 who fled in around 1975, and then the boat people in the late 70s to the 1980s, and then those who arrived through the orderly departure programs, including the Amerasians, the family sponsorship reunifications, as well as the HO programs, those who were in prison for 3 years and above in re-education camps, and their families were allowed to come to America. So you have to understand that these three groups kind of built the foundations for what we know as the diaspora in the U.S., in Canada, in France, and Australia, right? They carry with them a strong refugee identity, right? When you talk to them, they call themselves refugees, not immigrant, right? Người tị nạn, right? And a deep historical memories that is tied to the war, we have, right? Tied to loss, tied to exile, tied to the Republic of Vietnam, right? Tied to anti-communism, right? But this dominant narrative is often overlooked, often overlooks two other groups, all right? And we often don't even mention those two groups. The first group is the groups of Vietnamese who live abroad before 1975. Though small, these are people who comes to America to study during the war, right? And decided to stay. Though small, but they have a different ways of thinking and reflecting about Vietnam and about the community. They don't really engage much with the community, for example. And then you have the other group that you just mentioned, the growing number of migrants arriving since the late 1990s or the early 2000s to now, including workers, students, professionals, right? Students who come to America, study and stay and become professionals in Silicon Valleys, as well as family members who've been newly sponsored to America, right? You have the first generation sponsoring new or marrying other folks from Vietnam and bringing them here into America. And so what you see is that it really, these people who came from a very different Vietnam, right? And over time, I think, like you're right, in the next 5-10 years, as their number increase, their presence will challenge and complicate existing diaspora identity, right? Some will integrate. I think some will integrate into the political and cultural frameworks created by the earlier waves if they share those ideas, right? Others will diverge completely away from it and creating new, perhaps more competing understanding of what it means to be Vietnamese abroad.
Alex,
right?
Let me share something with you that I found out last year. You know, there's the VSA, the traditional Vietnamese student associations that you find all across the country, right? I recently found out that there's a VSA that is for Du Học Sinh, so that it's not blended in with the mainstream VSAs. I think that there is this I know for a fact that there are Vietnamese student groups that are for the students that are coming from Vietnam, and they're not the same. They're not meeting. It's kind of underground, I think. And it's very interesting to hear the divergent patterns that you just talked about. And I, you know, because we're in this really strange atmosphere of the Trump administration, and there's so many Vietnamese Americans that are, you know, pro-Trump, it makes me think about how scared these people are when they're thinking about, you know, these new waves of immigrants that are coming from Vietnam that eventually, like you said, in 5-10 years, their voices might be in diametric opposition to how some of the original Vietnamese American diaspora members might feel.
Yeah, and that's why it goes back to the one of my answer to your questions earlier about recognizing each other's existence, right? And it's not just recognizing each other's existence in past history, you know, but recognizing each other's existence currently, you know, as we are dealing with each other and where each and every one of us comes from, right? Those of these of the first generations, right, the first three waves, has to recognize the influx of newer Vietnamese coming in and where they are coming from. The experiences that they live differs from that of our experience from the past. But vice versa, right? Right? Those who comes to America, the newer Vietnamese, in a way has to kind of integrate themselves into, open themselves up to understanding the history of these people and why they left and why they exist here in America. Because they, in a certain way, were the ones who lay the foundations for what is the Vietnamese community here in America, the little Saigon that allows for the newer generations to come in and more easily integrate into American society, right? And so understanding and having an open mind and open heart to understanding each other's stories, listening to each other and getting accustomed to each other's dialect, right? The different Zhong Minh Nam, Zhong Minh Bắc. I can totally understand, you know, for example, a person from Hanoi coming to America, marrying into, let's say, a child of a refugees coming to America, and then one day, you know, walk out into Phuc Lộc Thọ, and then goes up to a Lee sandwich and order a sandwich with a northern accent, and the reaction around that person, right, would be, whoa, this person is from the north,
right?
Right? Oh, he or she is communist, yeah, or gone on Georgia, right? But I think it's more complex than that, right? It demands that we become more acceptance and more understanding, and right,
wow,
and recognize the changes, right? But also understand the sensitivity of the people in which that exists in that community, right? You're exactly right. I remember the VSG, or when I was at Cornell, we had something called the Vietnamese Student Association, so VSA. And I remember leading to that 1 year, we were helping organizing one of the event there. And one of the skit says that Saigon was is the capital of Vietnam. Right. And one of the member of the VSA, a graduate student from Vietnam, from Hanoi, vehemently wrote out email saying, no, you guys are wrong. The capital of Vietnam is not Saigon, it's Hanoi. I'm not going to participate in this activities anymore because you guys are wrong and whatnot. I'm not saying who's wrong and who's right here, but I think there's a misunderstanding. And unwillingness from both sides to really have an understanding and communicating to understand why one still perceives Saigon as the capital, right? Because that's the identity of the refugees who lost their country and they still hold on to that. That exists within our community. And then you have the newer groups of Vietnamese who comes and all their lives are shaped by this understanding that Hanoi is the capital, right? Both are true. Right, both exist, right, and we cannot tell people to get rid of that, but we have to understand each other and communicate and accept, right? So I trust that with times, as memories among the overseas Vietnamese will shift, it has to shift, raising urgent questions about it will raise questions about identity. It will raise questions about change, continuity, as well as what it means to be home or what it means to be community within a community, right? So,
you know, I think what would have been cool is if that, I don't know if that politically would be sensitive or not, but in that Cornell story you just told, perhaps in the play, or was it a play or something?
It was a play, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That would have been brought up. You know, that would have been cool if they could have integrated that into the storyline between the two and then have it like duked out and played out on stage. That would be, you know, I don't know how politically sensitive that would be, but it would be interesting for people to hear about it and to know about it. But we often hear that history is written by the victors. And in the case of Vietnam, how has that dominant narrative been shaped by the outcomes of the war, and what alternative perspectives exist out there beyond the current victor perspective? What has been overlooked? What can you say to that?
Very, very good question. But just to go back to your point about the skit a little bit, I think, you know, the story that I told you happens about nearly 20 years ago, right? Or 50, 60 years ago, right? I think now with the more integrations of different Vietnamese at, you know, university settings, more skits have kind of reflected, you know, what you suggested, right? The multiple perspectives on what is Vietnam, right? So, but yeah, going back to your questions, and I think we kind of talk about this about, you know, and it's a common phrase that people said, you know, history is written by victors, right? I often say that history is written by the powerful, right? America lost the war, right? But America controlled the narratives from the American and Western perspectives.
Great point. Right?
So it's not just the victor, but certainly we know that the dominant narrative has been shaped by the outcome of the war. A triumph story of national liberations against foreign aggressions, against France and against America, told by the communist states in Vietnam. That's all you hear, right? You rarely hear of anything else. In the U.S., in the West, right, the focus has long been trying to explain why the U.S. fell. why it was defeated, right? So all these narratives within these frameworks, alternative voices, for example, the Republic of Vietnam and those associated with it, have been marginalized, their stories kind of like silenced and erased. But I think more than that, right? The war kind of like has become the total lens through which we view Vietnamese history, modern Vietnamese history at least, or how we view that period from 1954 or 1945, if you want to push it back to now, right? And kind of like war kind of consumed everything. Right. Yeah. So when we talk about Vietnam, it's the Vietnam War. Right. So we kind of start with the war to kind of explain everything and forget that beyond the battlefield, there exists, for me, something called society, lives, dreams, and as well as contradictions on all sides. Right. In America, in Vietnam, in the North, in Vietnam, in the South. So for me, to truly understand Vietnam's past, we need to move beyond the war. So as much as I myself study about the war, I recognize that we need to move away from the war and perhaps liberate ourselves from the confines of war-centered history and kind of shift our gaze toward lived experience, right? You
know, yeah. In the beginning of the podcast, I tried to do that in the first few years, which is to focus on modern Vietnamese people throughout the diaspora, throughout Vietnam. But inevitably it led me back to the war, because what I realized is the things that I was saying with the modern sort of interviews and podcast episodes is that I think I was speaking out of a very shallow understanding of where I came from. And the more now that I dig in with, you know, guys like you and Kevin Pham and Anh Tung Vu, I realize without a full understanding of the war, it's kind of tough to talk about the space culturally. And that leads me to the next question, which I didn't prepare for you, but this is coming out of this sort of like right now in this moment, is reconciliation. And that seems to be a bad word, I think, in the Vietnamese diaspora. And I say that, you know, tongue in cheek. I say that seriously. I say that in all respects, the R word is a bad word. You just don't want to hear it. But I keep hearing younger people say, well, you know, how do we do this? And I hear older people say, well, until the Vietnamese government recognizes that there was this other government that existed and we invaded them, you know, Hanoi invaded the South. And until that sort of can be defined, then there will never be a reconciliation. But I find that to be all impossible to achieve from. So I wanted to ask you, do you think that reconciliation is needed? Obviously, it's probably very important, but is it needed and is it possible?
Reconciliation, a very trigger word, right? And it's triggered for various reasons. And is it needed, right? I think it all depends on everyone, right? We cannot impose on any person whether they should or should not reconcile, because everyone comes from a different experience the war differently, experience the post-war period differently, experience the diaspora differently. Well, we don't know how what went through their experiences, right? And we cannot therefore impose on them that they must reconcile in order for us to move forward. Maybe they choose not to. That's fine, right? Because what if they lost their whole family, right? What if they had to carry their daughter off a boat, her bodies, and bury them in some island in Indonesia and Malaysia to this very day that they still refuse to go back and visit the graves? It's too painful, right? And vice versa, right? There are people who are advocating for reconciliations, like myself, for example. But I'm not going to impose that upon people who are reluctant to do that. And I have to respect myself and respect other of that. But why is reconciliation such a trigger word? I think it's not really so much a trigger word when you say it in English. And so for example, in a platform like us here today, when we discuss this topic in English, we use the word reconciliation, it becomes misleading. And when we say it's a trigger word, it's a bad word, then it's misleading in the sense that from an English understanding of reconciliation, it doesn't have that negative connotation to it. From the Vietnamese community, especially the Vietnamese diaspora community, reconciliation, when you translate it into Vietnamese, is called hòa hợp hòa giải, right? Hòa hợp hòa giải itself sounds very mundane, right? Sounds very nice, right? But it's a phrase coined by the Vietnamese government, the current Vietnamese government, kind of imposing on the Vietnamese community that they need to hòa hợp hòa giải, meaning they need, what is hòa hợp? Hòa hợp is blending in together. And then hòa giải, to reconcile, right? And so for the Vietnamese community or those who experienced the war differently than yourself or myself or with a lot of Americans, that notion is very difficult for them to accept when you are not recognizing us in history. So if we open up a history text in Vietnam, you still call us Nguyen, or you still call us illegitimate, you call us puppet, meaning you don't really recognize our existence, my existence, then what is there to reconcile, right? If you don't allow me to participate as a citizen like I would normally be, if you don't return my properties, my homes that you took away in 1975, there are people who held on to things like that. They lost those stuff that we don't, right? And so if they feel like, if you are mistreating me when I go on Facebook and try to say something and then you said I am a fandom, right? Then how are you reconciling with me. So they see it from a different perspective, that this is a concept that is imposing upon them without really truly extending the hands out and with policies that really accept them back as part of the historical narrative, right? Accept them back as maybe as businessmen, businesswomen, to make the country better. Yes. Not necessarily accepting them as an alternative in historical narratives, right? And that's why we don't see that exist. Every April 30th anniversary, the Vietnamese government in Vietnam would put together massive parades and call it Ngày Giải Phóng. Well, for these people, it's a dagger into their heart. What are you liberating? I mean, you are pushing us to see and to seek life in another land that we don't really want to be in, right? So 50 years after the war, are you still going to call Giải Phóng to us in front of our face? And while also say, let's reconcile. So it's a trigger word because of different understanding.
Totally. And I think, well, when I think about the word Giải Phóng, from the Vietnamese government today, their point of view, I don't know if they're really considering how that triggers the Vietnamese diaspora. I don't know if they care. That's, I think, the most important thing. I don't think that they care. But to take it maybe another step further is that maybe in their own mind, I think when they speak out to the world and to themselves, they liberated themselves from the French and from the U.S. and any invader. And I think it's a kind of a representative catchphrase for them to say, hey, we are responsible for our own journey through the history of mankind, and we've liberated ourselves from foreign powers. And I think we, as the Vietnamese diaspora, is ensnared in that narrative because of our own history of being from the motherland. And I think it's such a complicated, nuanced phrase when we think about Giải Phóng, the liberation of Vietnam from foreign invaders and foreign powers.
Well, I mean, certainly you can take that angle from the perspective of the Vietnamese government when they use that phrase. But for example, my question is, if you continue using that phrase, knowing that phrase would divide the people that you are trying to reintegrate back into, then you especially, the Vietnamese government is in the position of power now, right? They're in the position of whether they want to use it or not. Even if they chose not to use it, I don't think that it's going to delegitimize them any less, anymore, right? But maybe it would open them to be more acceptance by people in the community, right? Because if and historically, if you want to make an argument in that sense, by 1973, after the signing of the Paris Peace Treaty, American troops are no longer in Vietnam, right? The war continued to be fought by Vietnamese of both sides, right? And 1975, when North Vietnamese tanks and Viet Cong tanks come into Saigon, they call it Giải Phóng, right? Really liberate. I mean, and if you historically, and this becomes the part of the research, right? I'm currently researching ideas and perceptions after 1975, immediately right after 1975. How does the Communist Party and leaders of the Communists view those in the South? And they truly felt like they were liberating these people from all the bad stuff that they were influenced with from the West and whatnot, all the negative things that were going on in the South, right? They put people like my father into re-education camp and saying that, why is it called liberation? Re-education camp. Gai tao is in order to liberate these people from their faults, right? Chúng tôi giải phóng các anh từ những cái suy nghĩ xấu xa mà các anh đã, right? So these concepts they're not confined to just liberating the country from France dominations or US influence, but they are also used to depict the people associated with, right, the other side of it, to create the binary of us versus them. And for me, is that 50 years after the war, I think terminologies, as much as earlier when we're talking about the Vietnamese community here in America needs to adapt to the newer waves of Vietnamese coming in and vice versa. I think 50 years after the war, it's not so much to ask to let's move beyond certain terms in order so that we can come together better. And I think when Vietnamese in Vietnam and in the diaspora comes together, there's so much that we can contribute to the betterment of the country, to the betterment of our understanding of history, to the betterment of creating better society, to the betterment of constructing Vietnam economically and politically and whatnot. And so, yes, reconciliation is, if you ask most people in the diaspora the true meaning of what they think reconciliation is and whether they, if they want reconciliation, like the English definition of it, I think most want reconciliation, right? Because again, at the end of the day, as much as we say that this is the war, from the Vietnamese government's perspective, the war against France, against America, at the end of the day, it's a war between Vietnamese. Fathers were fighting their sons, right? When 1954, the father would go up to the north, became an officer, comes back down south, and his son would grow up to be an officer in the south. Father would visit re-education camp to see his son sitting there, both of them looking at each other and saying, "Dad, I don't know what to say to you. Go home," right? Father would be there when the son comes back from re-education camp. They sat at Masachiwe at home, not knowing what to say to each other. Brothers fighting in war, turn around pointing at a gun at the other person. The other person turns around. They both fell down to the ground crying because they were brothers sitting there. And I'm saying that with emotion because those are stories that have been told to me by people who experienced that themselves. So who are they really liberating or who is being liberated here? The reality is we need to recognize that this was a war in which Vietnamese fought each other, kill each other, right? And so people, especially like people like my father, are very, very ready to reconcile. I remember when I took the job I think I told this story in the past podcast, but to help with researching to find missing communist soldiers lost in war. And I called my dad up and said, "Dad," just out of respect to him, I said, "Dad, I'm going to go do this job to try to help find the remains of communist soldiers, those who are on the side of the people who put you in prison and took away your homes and kicked your sons out of universities and things like this and created the lives that we have now in America. What do you think?" Without hesitation, he said, "Do it. You must do it. Because at the end of the day, we are all Vietnamese and we are all human."
Mm.
We understand who we are in history. We understand our positions, but we need to do what is right. And I think that is reconciliation without really necessarily having to use the term, right?
There's a lot to process, and I'm emotionally moved by your response. But I couldn't help think about how the government of Vietnam would respond to our conversation right now. And I keep thinking about that. Are you still going back and forth to Vietnam?
Yeah. I was there last year. For the first time after 10 years. There was some struggle with the opportunities to go back to Vietnam. Not sure who is at fault here, but partly has to do a lot with the sensitive nature of my research.
Yeah.
And so I didn't go back to Vietnam for almost 10 years, whereas before that I go back to Vietnam almost every year.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it wasn't until last year I went not on on a personal basis, but I went with my university. And then I stay an additional few weeks to go back to Vietnam and return diaries, letters, notebooks, artifacts that were captured during the Vietnam War to families or relatives and families of soldiers who were killed in the war. So we had a ceremony in Hanoi, right, at the Museum of the Women's Museum in Hanoi, where we returned 40 items, records, diaries, journals belonging to communist soldiers who left the north to go down south, but were either captured, were either killed, and we gave it back to them in that ceremony. And I know you didn't ask this question, but it goes back to that word reconciliation, and myself as the second generation's understanding the history, but understanding my family's history. I love the fact that I was able to stand right there together with my colleague, handing over these diaries, which I researched through and locate the families in order to return to them, right? Many cry, many for the first time seeing the writings of their siblings, of their father. So for example, this one story that every time I read this, I cry. It's basically a short letter that a gentleman who left the North wrote back to his wife and his parent asking, how's everything at home? And then asking his wife, how is my daughter Nghĩa? Does she remember who I am? How's the other daughter? Does she even know who I am? So what does that say? That says that, you know, when he left, they were very young. One is probably just born, that she doesn't even know his name, recognize him. So he asked, do you think they recognize me? It's been 5 years already, kind of. And of course, he passed away, right? So when we return that to them, the mother has, or the wife has passed away already. The parents has passed away. The two daughters are now in the 50s, near 60s. They receive those letters, just photocopies of the captured documents from 1967. Tears just comes down, right? This was their first time seeing the writings of their father. So for me, reconciliation and going back to going, you know, back to Vietnam and being able to do things like this, it really, for me, really brings closure, helps bring closure, not just for these people, but also for myself. It really allows me to understand that, you know, despite our differences, whether it's our experiences, ideology, there are commonalities, common things that we can together do in order to bring closure, in order to uplift each other up, practical things that we can do. And so, yeah, I hope that, you know, with last year's trip in the future, I would be able to go back to Vietnam more in order to do this. Because what, at least, you know, from captured documents, we have more than 2.7 million documents or pages of documents being captured during the war that could be returned to these families. And imagine the closure that you can help bring to these families who to this very day can still haven't been able to find the remains of their fathers, of their husbands, of their brothers and sisters.
I was just talking to Dr. Jay Veit yesterday, had him on the podcast, and reflecting the same thing, you know, the US POW MIA situation. And yeah, both sides lost tremendously, and it's a topic that never gets old to me, but I get tired of it. You know, it's a very exhausting topic, this topic of all the things that that happened during that time. But here we are 50 years later, and you are organizing a conference about 1975, the end of the Vietnam War. And can you tell me how this event, this conference came together?
Yeah, I mean, like the Vietnam Center and Archive, where I work at Texas Tech University, is outside of the U.S. government, and the Vietnamese government is the largest center with information on Vietnam, right? We have over 30 million pages of documents and artifacts that we digitize over a third of it to make it available for everyone in the world to get access to and do it. Their research and their study of the Vietnam War. We have documents of, you know, the refugees in refugee camps sending to American applications here, things like that. So,
Alex, before you go on, where can we find that online?
So, you can find it on our website. So basically, just go on Google and type in. Texas Tech University Vietnam Center and Archive, and then that would lead you into our archive space, and then that would lead you into our digital archive, where you can get access to maps, to documents that has been digitized, right? But barely one third of we have, right? Yep. So as a center that, you know, was established since 1989, right? For the past, you know, so many years, we've organized these conferences that focus on the Vietnam War as a platform for many people to come together in order to share their experiences, to share their studies. We tend to focus on an anniversary year. So, for example, in 2018, a conference on 1968, the Tet Offensive. In 2023, we did a conference that focused on the Paris Agreement. So this year is 2025, 50 years. We reflect on 1975 and the end of the Vietnam War as part of our longstanding tradition of annual conferences that basically bring together, we try to bring together as many presenters as possible. And this year, we are bringing together over 100 presenters from around the world, right? And the great thing about that is that we're going to have nearly half of that being Vietnamese or Vietnamese American scholars who are presenting to offer, you know, their diverse and often overlooked perspectives. So our goal as a center is to create, like I said again, a platform for open, nuanced, and inclusive conversation ranging from military to strategy to civil society, from music to refugees' experiences, so that we can move beyond the singular narratives of just the war fighting only, right? So that we can have a fuller, more human understanding of the war and its aftermath. And that has always been our focus. And so we hope that this is going to be a productive year. Our conferences and the panels are all recorded. So for those who cannot make it, we record it and then we put it also on our website after the conference. So you can get access to it, to this year's conference, to last year's conferences and the conferences from previous years as a source that you can study or you know, just learn new things about Vietnam, Vietnam War, and post-war Vietnam.
You know, as usual, I always have so many questions, but I'm just due to time. I'm going to skip over a few of these questions because you kind of answered them earlier, but I have two last ones that I want to get through. This idea of the good side and the bad side. I was working on this VinFast brand, spot that I did for the car company, VinFast in Vietnam. And VinHomes, VinGroup, VinFast, these are companies that that exist in Vietnam. And as I was doing one of these shows, one of the guests that I had on had said, we're on the good side. And I said, whoa, 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 whoa. Good side, bad side. And I was like, oh my God, I got to talk to Alex about this because I am curious that when some of us makes this uncomfortable reference to the good side or the bad side. These are nuanced discussions that are being lost. How can we approach these kinds of conversations, you know, the good, the bad, as we discuss both sides of the Vietnamese global community?
Man, such a good question, right? And we get this all the time, right? We get, we sit in dinner table and, you know, certain family members, we say that we are on, you know, we were on the good side, you know, we are still on the good side. And then I could imagine, and I've seen this, you know, if you go to Vietnam and you go to the north and you talk to veterans in the north, right? I mean, yeah, last year when we did that ceremony, we were sitting in there for, I think, 2 or 3 hours. And the first half hour or hour, we were witnessing, you know, revolutionary songs, performances about killing Americans and killing Republic of Vietnamese soldiers. As I was sitting there, and next to me was my colleague, Ron Milam, who was a former Vietnam War vet. We're sitting there, you know, watching these, but with more with amusement and more with acceptance. Right, with acceptance that these people have a different experience, they have a different ideologies, they have a different understanding of their position in history and their role in history. Right, we're not going to be able to. We're not going to try to take that away from them, as we should not let, you know, us and our identity being taken away from us. So history is not always about. For me, history is not as much as we hear the stuff. History is not about declaring who is right and who is wrong, at least for me, right? But it's rather from a historical perspective, when I approach a topic, it's more about understanding why people believe they were in such a way, right? Why they believe they were wrong or right. So no interpretations of the Vietnam War is absolute, right? All share or shaped by personal experiences, losses, ideologies, and the historical conditions that that form them, right? So when someone at our dinner table say that, you know, their side, you know, they are on the good side, I'm less interested in judging that claim or being bothered by that claim, but rather I'm more interested in what shaped it, right? What about their role, suffering, and their memory that created that sense of belief in them? Because for me, that's more interesting, right? Because when you ask that question, it reveals more, right? They will tell you the different stories. So if someone who lost everything and who felt that they fought for democracy and lost everything and then now has to be in death, or who am I to say that their belief that they were on the good side is wrong? Right? Similar to a person who in the North who were, let's say, in a way, trained to believe that the South was suffering so much that they had to go down and fight to rescue the people in the South.
Yeah.
Who am I to say that, you know, that sentiment that they had at the time, whether it's wrong or not, right, is based on wrongful information or not, is not correct from their perspective, right? And so I try to understand what made them see the other side as enemies, right? My role as historians is not to correct this type of views, but to trace their personal, political, and cultural background that gave rise to them. So nuance is not really imposing a type of balance that I see, but it's about listening closely enough to see belief is how belief is born or killed, or how memory is made or erased, right? And how people find meaning in their place in history, whether how they see themselves being right in history, right? So the question that you raise is kind of stretched beyond my expertise, but that's how I kind of like approach history, is that I believe it comes down to a lot when you live in a world now 50 years after the war, where Vietnam is so much integrated into the global world, where there's so much exchanges between Vietnamese from within the country and in the diaspora, that I think, especially in dealing with businesses, in politics, we have a lot of representatives in America who are Vietnamese, American refugees background, who has to meet politicians from Vietnam. And certainly, you know, the community would react differently to each meetings, right? I think it comes down to intent, a sense of awareness and honest communication. So I believe Vietnamese Americans in the community will understand if we communicate ourselves to our family and to our community and our partners in Vietnam clearly our intention and what we do, why we do our things and our positions. I don't think, let's say, just the confidence of the Vietnamese people in America, I don't think they are unreasonable. But oftentimes, from what I see, is a lot of people making decisions but not being sensitive to the nature of the environment in which they are situated,
right,
to the nature of the history in which, you know, frame the people in their surrounding and themselves, as well as not being able to communicate that message over. And that goes back to the generational gap that we talked about earlier, right? The language barriers. A lot of us of the second generations, 1.5 generation, third generations, maybe we know how to order a bowl of pho and proudly saying, I'm Vietnamese. But maybe we're not able to construct a full paragraph to have a dialogue with our parents and grandparents' generation in order for them to have an understanding of why we have a friend whose father is a minister of foreign affairs, right? But if you have that language, if you can communicate, if you can find a way in which you can communicate that, then it's perfectly fine. And I say this, why? Because, for example, I have a friend who is a son of a very high-ranking diplomat. We studied together, and when I went back to Vietnam some 10 years ago to do research, he invited me to stay with his family, with his grandparents, the place where his father lives. And I stayed with him for 3 months. And through that experience, I learned so much in terms of the humanity, rather than, oh, that person is an official of the communist regime. And vice versa. When he went to Southern California, he went over to stay with my parents. And certainly, you know, when he entered the door, he would see the yellow flag with the three stripes. But my parents opened their arms, cooked for him, right? Share the bed. So I think engagement like these are not impossible, but it's how we, as representative of who we are, communicate our intent, our purpose to each other, to make them feel aware of what is going on, right? And then I think people have the heart to understand and to reconcile, to allow for us to come together.
Alex, you've answered the last question so eloquently. That was, you know, basically maybe you read ahead of the questions and you knew that was where we're going to end. And you really summed it up so beautifully. It's really just stating our intentions, making it always clear, being honest about it. And I think that it's hard to challenge once you get down to the sort of the details of both sides. It's like, all right, well, we understand it. And if you don't know, I don't think that there's a whole lot of disagreement in terms of, like, once you go and you're really honest with your sort of intentions, you know, nobody can really fight that. You know, this is what we have on our minds. I want to wish you good luck on the conference next week. I will do everything in my power to be there in spirit and in mind. And I will be watching many of the recorded panels that you will be having. I'm very interested in what you've put together. Alex, thank you once again for being on the Vietnamese podcast today.
No, Kenneth, again, thank you so much for giving me the platform to just communicate with yourself and other. And for myself, an opportunity with these questions that you pose to reflect on my understanding of history. I think these questions that you raise are so important. And oftentimes, even myself as a historian, you do the craft of learning history, but you don't really position them in questions. And these are questions that really deals with reality in which we live our life, right? 50 years after the war. So thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. And I look forward to having you on all the time. I think, as Kevin Pham has had a sub-series, I always welcome sub-series with my previous guests. I think they're fascinating, especially when you're dealing with archives and millions of pages that have not been examined. We can, come together once you're all done with the conference and perhaps create a sub-series or have you just back on regularly to talk about all of the things, all the things you find. So thank you so much and have a great conference next week.
Thank you. Anytime. Thank you, my brother. Yeah, I bet it's not too feedback.
Eloquent. You explain things so well,
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I felt like I just meandered around a little bit and then I was like, oh, did I answer his questions? But
yeah. But meandering is important because we get to see the details, when people meander and when people go off, we get to see bigger picture or even we get to get more narrower into the details. So I welcome all of it.
Yeah, I tend to like with any questions that you raise, I tend to give like a general observation of it and insert within that a kind of like narrative, an experience, just to humanize it a little bit more. But hey, great with what you are doing. Love this. And if you need anything, not just from myself, I remember previously you tried to contact John Fan. Have you done something with him?
Yes, he finally had a book come out, so he reached back out to
me. Right.
That's so funny.
The reason I asked is because his book just came out, so certainly you should do that one. That one is going to be an important one. So many scholarship are coming out. So if any topic that you want to reach out to, let me know and I can try to reach out to folks and contact folks. Have you ever spoken to Jennifer Hun?
Do you know? Yeah, she reached out yesterday to me. Yeah. I met her at the Oregon conference last time. Okay. And bumped into her a few times, but she still hasn't come on yet. I'm not sure.
Yeah, because
some people are not. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'll try to convince her if you want. I'll try to convince her next week. She came out with a book recently too, so I think it would be good to. Some people they're just not as comfortable. I am not at all comfortable, but then just have to show myself. That's why I have this.
I used to take it very personally when people would not respond and then I began to understand years later when they would come to me and they say, oh my God, I am so nervous on camera. I am so scared and intimidated. And then I began to understand, oh my God, people are not what I like, I just tend to take everything personally. I'm like, that's, I really wish it wasn't me about me, but it's people have this phobia to. Yeah. I'm beginning to understand.
Yeah, as much as I've done so many interviews over the, let's say, past 5 years, I've never watched any, including yours, because of that phobia, right? I hate hearing my voice. I hate looking at myself. So every time I do an interview and then a studio would send me the recording, I would never open it and whatnot. So I can totally understand it from other people's perspective. But next week, I'll meet a lot of people, and I'll send you a list of maybe after that, I'll send you a list of people that I see as maybe great candidates that you could try to bring in. Yeah,
that'd be great. And then, you know, if you ever want to start a sub-series with me, called the archival, you know, Vietnamese archival sub-series within the Vietnamese podcast, like I did with Kevin Pham. We've done like 12 of them now, me and Kevin. It's awesome.
Yeah, because I've seen those episodes. I really enjoy them. Kevin's so great with his materials. After May, this year I'm so committed to so many different community events and a lot of traveling. But yeah, we can totally do a sub-series on the archive and the exploration into history. I can totally envision the first episode now in a funny way. Wow. Just because last week I went back to Southern California to visit my family. And sometimes, you know, you take your family so for granted. So I spent a lot of time studying about other people, about Ho Chi Minh, about all the topics, right? Mm-hmm. And I've always told myself, you need to study your family. You need to interview your parents. So my father's health is failing, right? And so last week I made an emergency trip back just so that I can interview him, right? Yeah. But prior to coming back, I sorted out collections of documents that he has held on to for so many years, and he gave to me during my last trip so that I could help him sort it out. So as I was sorting it out, so there was a pile like this that says papers for coming to America, right? Zaita de kwa me, right? So applications that comes to America, you know. And then I opened it, I was like, oh shoot, this is dad's re-education camp release document. So on the release document, I read it. It's just his name. He was released and it said, oh, he was given 40 dong to go. He was given 2 days to go home. And then I didn't know. I turned the back and they slid the paper up in the back and they wrote, he has to check in with the local government every month on this date for a year before. So had I not seen those documents, I was like, I wouldn't have known that part of the history, right? And then I got to the next document, which is like kind of like that. So it's called the Khai Li Lịch. So when if you're in Vietnam, everyone has to, when you do any kind of paper document things, you have to write a Li Lịch, right? You explain your family's background. And there was a part where he got to my brothers, my siblings. He said, "Có tám con. Con thứ nhất sinh năm 1968, học lên đại học năm thứ ba, không được học tiếp vì không thuộc diện đào tạo." Right? Meaning what? I'm like, I read it. I'm like, I knew that my brother was kicked out of university, but that phrasing tells me that, oh, shoot, by the third year, they recognized that he was part of the older regime. So he was kicked out of university because he was not part of the Diễn được đào tạo. And then my second brother, who was born 1966, I never questioned this. I never questioned why he didn't go to college in Vietnam. I always took it for granted, but never really questions why. Because when he came to America, he was most successful academically and whatnot. And so the phrase next to him was like, Võ Đình Thu sinh năm 1966, không được vào đại học.
Wow.
Right? So that is archival research right there that tells a whole, you know, story.
Narrative of family.
Yeah, we can do episodes like that where we explore, or we can do episode where we explore the letters and the diaries that sent back to wives. And
just focus on the wives' diaries or something like that. We just go really hard on that. And I'll have questions about like, you know, different, I would love to hear different stories and things that you've read and how the whole process of returning that and the ceremony in Hanoi, like all of that is beautiful. So let's get this going when you get a free moment.
Sure.
And, you know, it lifts your profile too as a academic and as a person in the community worldwide. You know, people, you know, Kevin told me a few weeks ago, he's like, somebody recognized him at the airport. They're like, aren't you on the Vietnamese podcast? You have that sub-series with Kenneth. It was so crazy. But I mean, his sub-series is getting thousands of hits. Right. It's a crazy, right. crazy stuff.
It's great. So, it's great. And I know, you've reached out to me to in the first episode to really try to talk about the archive and work.
Yeah.
And we can totally do like a whole series or a sub-series.
I would love an episode just on your experience in Vietnam working in the archives. Like that whole thing is an episode in itself. Like why would they let you in? What did you see when you're down there? What was it like to, you know, pull this information and your emotions? What were you going through? All of that. Just in your work in Vietnam archives is like, for me, is an episode. It's a full episode.
So we can do a sub-series on that, and we start that with the first episode on introducing the archive.
You let me know when you're ready. I'm ready to go, always. All right, brother. Have a great conference, and we'll talk very soon.
Great. Thank you so much, brother.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.